He serviced over 9,000 families in Austin. And you're talking about a town with only 250,000 people. It's a significant number.
Community hospitals that can provide access to medical care at a third the cost, that meant you're taking two-thirds of that dollar out of someone else's pocket. So you had larger hospitals in Austin that wanted to expand, but they couldn't expand. So word got out, don't refer to Dr. Nasur. And if you do, this is the cost. There were a couple of doctors that stood up and did it, and they quickly lost their privileges.
One very dear friend of his that was a physician had to disassociate himself with my father.
No one ever referred to him, and they would never take his referrals. There were false accusations being made.
It was front page news, doctor in South Austin, you know, trafficking babies. What that was about was he was known amongst the Diocese of Austin and San Antonio as being a physician that would take in a young pregnant woman that was considering an abortion because she couldn't afford the care necessary to have the baby. He would give them free prenatal care and take care of them afterwards on the condition that if they chose not to keep the baby, that they would give the baby up for adoption. So somehow that translated into selling babies and baby trafficking. A couple of weeks later, on page 25 of the paper, there was a retraction.
Employees who were working at other hospitals had overheard conversations to the effect that we can't allow Dr. Nasur to continue to practice in South Austin.
The Medical Association sued him. They wanted the hospital closed. They tried what they could. They did not want the competition. I guess he kind of responded the same way he did when he was a little boy and was getting picked on. He started to fight. He went to several attorneys. He was striking out with every attorney because you're going after Goliath, and you don't even have a rock in your sling. Percy Foreman, one of the most prominent attorneys ever to practice law, he was looking at taking my dad's case. And my dad says, where's the justice in this, you know? And Percy Foreman put his hands on his shoulder and he says, Dr. Nasur, how much justice do you want to buy? He says, I'll get you all the justice, you know, you want, but it's going to be expensive. He shares with my dad what the retainer was going to be. And it was north of $100,000, and this is 40 years ago.
Trying to figure out the law, how to protect himself, what's his right.
He even went to law school because he was going to defend himself.
He came in there. He was sitting in on classes without authorization. He didn't qualify to go to law school. But they didn't say anything when he said, well, I'm just going to sit in. They said, yeah, whatever. He just wanted to sit in and learn the law because he was going to sue the AMA. So I got involved in that and started visiting the congressman and all that, trying to get some people behind it. But it's hard to get the local congressman against the AMA, you know.
Just couldn't win.
In Herbert's case, there was no reason for him not to be admitted to practice medicine except for, I think, his political views. And they just didn't want him in there. And that's the only thing. He was a good doctor. He was somebody that would have health care for everybody at no cost. I mean, you know, he didn't work with the system very well at all.
We used to be packed with patients. The lobby was always full. And now all of a sudden, you know, there's probably three patients in a 28-bed hospital. And I never understood why it all of a sudden slowed down.
My dad wasn't really open about the struggle. I mean, he didn't want the kid to worry about it. That's when he started changing a lot at that time. He wasn't really talking to us much. He was working in a garden by himself. He did pray a lot.
He encountered financial difficulties because of a Blue Cross Blue Shield not paying. He encountered financial difficulties because of the non-referral of other physicians, you know, to him.
But what really shut down the hospital was the IRS.
They did not believe that he would only pay himself a small amount. They could not believe that he would charge out so much, but only receive so much in return.
This is what we estimate the income should have been for those years and those procedures, and we're going to call this income to you. And you're now going to pay taxes, you know, on that phantom income. And further, as a result of you not operating this hospital as a nonprofit because you did these things, we're going to revoke your nonprofit status. So they revoke his nonprofit status, and when they do that, Travis County goes, wait a minute, if they're revoking your nonprofit status, we're not going to allow you to be non-exempt for property taxes. So they hit him with property taxes for about 15 years. The property taxes at the time were about $500,000. The income taxes was about $1.2 million. Penalty and interest, IRS taxes because of that, and then Blue Cross, it was just too much. He couldn't overcome that.
There were Catholic brothers that were helping him with his bookkeeping. And I overheard one of them say if he could collect everything that is owed to him from his patients, he could keep the hospital open. And I went to Dad, and I asked Dad, I said, Dad, why don't you just go collect the money that's owed to you, and then the hospital could stay open? And he said, sweetheart, I wouldn't take $1 from these people. I would rather see my hospital go out of business than to ask these people for $1.
There was a point, you know, when he just did not have the resources to maintain salaries, to keep the lights on.
He literally quit going. You know, Mom would have to beg him to go to the clinic to honor his appointments. He quit admitting patients.
David versus Goliath, and in this case, Goliath won, and it was sad. You had a guy that would help anybody. To lose that, that was a big loss for the city.
Virginia and Sammy would be crying because Mom and Dad weren't talking.
I just think he was just drowning, and nothing was going his way. And he would really... tired, very tired. So my dad was totally angry with the world, with the IRS, Lane, AMA, Travis County, Austin, to where it's like, you know, if I just pack my bag and walk, it's gone. It's just gone. And that's what he did.
The marriage represented the history that he had. You know, he was under so much obligation with the Lebanese wife, the family that he was still trying to support. Everybody relied on Dad.
He carried everyone on his shoulders. He had big, broad shoulders, and he carried so much on him that I felt like he finally, you know, he just kind of not broke, but he kind of just... time to walk away. The house was no longer a home. Mom was very depressed.
The last 2-3 weeks, the hospital was open. He would only open a few hours in the evening. And I remember I would go see my dad every night just for a few minutes. And then he stopped coming. And there'd be patients out there for 2-3 weeks. They would come, they would park, they would wait for an hour, 2 hours. He didn't come, and they would leave. And they'd keep on coming.
The hospital was shut down. I didn't know how to reach out to him. I didn't know where he went. We lost touch. And we lost touch for 7 years.
I'm driving home, and I see him driving right next to me. So I followed him and confronted him and asked him what he was doing. He said, well, I work here now.
My brother called me and said, hey, Dad's at El Paso.
Herb said, Dad is here. And I was like, I don't think so. My feelings were hurt, you know? I felt like, hey, I'm your daughter. You know, you could have said.
We began to talk to each other. And I would meet him every morning for breakfast. We would talk. And we got to know each other again.
My brother Jimmy went to El Paso to tell him, Dad, I'm just here to tell you that we miss you and we love you. And this distance has just got to stop. We met him at the airport. We went to the mall. And we walked around the mall, circled the mall over and over, just talking and talking for hours. I told Dad, I said, Dad, I want you to know one thing. If you don't mind, I would like to talk about when you left Mom. Sure, honey. What do you want to talk about? And I said, I just want you to know, Dad, that Mama's okay. She's okay now. And Sammy and I, we're fine. We're happy. Mama's happy, and I'm happy, and Sammy's happy, and I just want you to be happy. I just want you to know that whatever happened between you and Mom, it's okay. You know, we love you. I want you to be happy. I just want you to be happy. He said, I appreciate that. And he didn't say any more.
The truth was, he was happiest serving, as far as the border city there at El Paso. It's a very densely populated city. At the time, you know, north of 1 million people. There was a particular parish that didn't even have a nurse, let alone a doctor.
People were dying at a much younger age, and a simple vaccine could protect them.
He couldn't just sit still. He saw the people in Juarez who were dying because of no medical care and deliveries. These women were in need, and he was so close. He was right there. He was in El Paso. They were in Juarez. He knew they needed help, and he just couldn't stop.
He did eventually open up the 3 clinic in Juarez.
And I remember he was real proud of a chart. He says, well, we delivered this many babies this year, and now we're at this. You know, he was charting it. He was so proud to see how many babies were being born, but he knew they needed help, and he just couldn't stop.
He funded them himself.
He sent donations galore, equipment, medicines, whatever supply he could.
I mean, simple things like antibiotics. That saved somebody.
He was involved in the development of the medical school in Juarez, and he used to teach there.
He loved Mexico. He loved the people. He loved the culture.
It reminded him of the education he got when he was in Lebanon.
He was always recruiting.
When he said, once you come to Juarez and go to medical school here.
Anytime he could add another doctor, you know, that was doing something.
There is a gatekeeping here in the U.S. The medical school here locally have a limit as to how many seats that they fill. In Juarez, there's not the limit.
It was also his way to promote that increase in the workforce in the medical field that will make the healthcare more accessible.
He wanted medical providers on every corner.
Anybody that would have any ailment, anybody that would come in to ask for help, he would do anything to help them.
I saw him take care of hematomas, lacerations, broken bones, STDs. You know, people come in with all kinds of complaints. He took care of it all. You know, till literally the day he died, he was seeing patients.
He was more connected with the population here in El Paso than he ever was in Austin.
It was a new him. It was a new phase. It was a phase of taking off the gloves and forgiving and just serving.
What's your favorite song? Favorite Arabic song?
When my dad was getting older, he was sick, and it made me worry to where I was going to El Paso the following week. And my mom stopped me and said, tell your dad If he need help, come home. I'll take care of him.
And to her dying day, she said if he ever came back, she'd have taken him back.
He was an inspiration. You know, I did everything I could to make him proud of me. I wanted to live up to his standards because I valued his standards. One of the kindest, most gentle, and a true example.
He had me believing that, you know, everybody should be able to afford medical attention. It was utopian, I guess, you know, but he knew it was possible.
No, I think Herbert touched everybody's life that was in contact with him. His vision of healthcare, not just in the U.S., but in the world, should be a human right. And as a human right, he believes that healthcare should be universal for everybody. Anybody and everybody should have access to healthcare, quality, accessible, and affordable healthcare.
He was a very, very talented doctor and surgeon. He could have been very wealthy. And he chose this. He did it because he was passionate about the poor. I mean, there's no other way to say it. He certainly didn't do it for profit. He did it for one reason. He did it because he believed that poor people should have access to the same health care everybody else did.
And I look back at all the people he mentored, all the people that are doctors, because he provided them that opportunity, all the patients that he treated. I mean, I'm overwhelmed.
He would always say, light the candle for someone else. If you could help someone with the little that you have, that's going to go a long way.
Do the best you can. Never hold back, and God will provide.
I think each one of us are fulfilling that dream in the way that we practice, in the way that we deliver that healthcare, or in the way we live and relate to others.
He's touched so many lives that I don't care what his bank account said or what building he left behind or didn't leave behind. He was a success.
I asked my dad, you know, one time I said, you lived a long life. I mean, you've lived during the Depression, roaring 20s, the Prohibition days, the boom. I said, if you could pick any spot in your time tunnel to be in, where would you want to be? He says, right now. He was looking for, you know, a system that was fair to all, accessible to all, and it can be done.